I'm Nicola Talkington.
And I'm Jo McGrath, and we're the founders of Flourish CIC. And this is a Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast. And in this episode, we're talking about careers in the social goods sector.
Flourish Together is an organisation that supports women to create positive social change. We offer women space, support, training, mentoring and access to funding to develop their ideas, themselves and their ventures. We do things differently and have supported over 500 women so far. This podcast came about because we've known for some time that women need to access support in different ways. Accessibility is a big issue, from events that are too expensive to others that are held during times of work or when kids need looking after. Also, people who are running social ventures are often doing it on top of day jobs or other commitments, so having tools and resources they can access in their own time is essential. We've seen a lack of diverse support led by social entrepreneurs themselves, including those that have lived and breathed it. In each episode, we look at a different theme to help you grow your understanding, knowledge and awareness of the wonderful world of social enterprise, innovation and leadership. You'll hear lively panel discussions with experts with lived experience who bring real honesty and insight. We want this podcast to help you on your journey to lead incredible social change. Let's get started. In this episode, we're talking about careers in social change and the weird and wonderful paths they can take. You'll hear from women changemakers just starting out, as well as seasoned pros who make a living and make a difference. Coming up, our producer Vic speaks to Eve Holt, who tells us about her inspiring journey from lawyer to changemaker to local councillor.
We get the lowdown on what it's like to work in the social goods sector and what young people really think of the career advice they're offered in school. That's all to come in our Flourish Talk section. But first, we'll take you to our recent panel discussion all about careers in the social goods sector. The event our panel is at is very lively, full of action and fun, which spills over into some of the sound on this section. I'll let our Vic explain all about the event. Over to Vic.
We are here at Manchester Central Library with Tandem Theatre Arts, and it's the finale of their heritage lottery-funded project, Game Changers. And it's bringing together girls from all 10 boroughs of Greater Manchester to learn about changing the world and taking inspiration from our suffragette sisters. I don't know, 150 people here today. Mums, dads, stalls, lots of beautiful artwork. And Flourish is here to talk to some of the people involved.
We've got a modern day panel here, and we just thought it'd be great to hear more about what they do, find out how they perhaps stumbled into this. We're going to ask all sorts of questions. We're going to start by just asking everybody to just say who they are, how they got into what they were doing.
Hi, my name's Bay, and I'm a business analyst, and just got into the beauty industry, and I run my own beauty business. I'm a beautician.
Hi, I'm Hala Moravage. I'm a senior lecturer in nutritional sciences, so I'm an academic. But I also run a social enterprise called MedMunch, and we do health, wellness, and sustainability, but using the students at university.
Hi, so my name's Nicola, and I live in Manchester, and I've started a tech company, which is an online finding app for people with alopecia, which is a hair loss condition I've had for 16 years.
Hi, my name is Marissa, and I run an organisation called Nourishing Dreams, which is based on my experiences of overcoming anorexia nervosa.
Hello, I'm Eve Holt, and I'm a director of Happen Together CIC, which is a community interest company, helping other people make the change they want to see in the world through a mixture of coaching and facilitation, lots on co-production and activism and campaigning, so lots of things like what's been going on today really, how we make sure that those spaces of democracy are inclusive spaces for everyone to participate in, I'm also a counsellor, so I'm a politician.
You know, what did people study at school? Does it bear any relation to what you're doing now?
When I went to college and university, I studied health and social care and nutrition and health sciences. And then eventually I think that led to understanding that there's a bigger element of health, like it's not just about food and nutrition, although it's a massive part, there's a massive psychological underpinning to well-being. So I think education really sparks a seed, and it's up to us to either follow that up and go on to further education or go into something completely different because that's what you're interested in.
Yeah, so I grew up in Manchester, kind of in Wally Range, my side, and I was always fired up. I was always on the playground that kind of was the mediator or that sort of stood up for people and fueled by a real sense of injustice in the world. So I very much looked, I ended up going into law because that was the only thing at the time that I saw as being a way to stand up for people. That was a tool for social justice, which is interesting because, of course, that is not the only way.
I had obviously a different education system. I came to UK when I was 16, and I did my A-levels here. So I've had a few lives before I got to the point that I'm now. Obviously, coming from a Persian family, you have to do medicine. And I've got every single cousin who's a doctor. And I actually didn't want to be a doctor. I was very creative, and I wanted to do something creative. Believe it or not, I actually wanted to be the Prime Minister. After the last 2 years of Brexit situation, I don't even want to go anywhere near politics. But actually, when I was sent to UK, I had to find myself really quickly, and had to really kind of like become quite self-resilient, and actually chose to go to Sheffield University. I don't even think my parents knew what university I was going to. Didn't even tell them what course I was doing. And I actually chose biomedical science because I thought it had a really cool kind of ring to it. And I did everything from biochemistry to pharmacology to, you know, neuroscience. But I didn't want to become a biomedical scientist because it was boring to be in a lab. And I just thought, I want to set up my own business. So I actually, straight after university, I set up a private clinic in a private hospital.
I wasn't particularly good at school. I didn't enjoy it that much. I mean, the academic side I found quite boring. But I think a lot of the extracurricular stuff, like we got this entrepreneurship challenge that I got stuck into. I just found it really exciting creating something of my own. And that kind of practical side of academia I found much more exciting. And I think that kind of sparked an entrepreneurship side in me.
Well, I've got a bit of a red herring story, because I studied, I did 5 A-levels. I was a bit of I loved school. I just got on with it because, you know, I enjoy most things. And I ended up sneaking an extra A-level in. That I wasn't supposed to do. My lovely CDT teacher, Mr. Peatfield, let me study design on my own. So this is freak. Well, everyone else was off having fun. I was having fun with welding torches and making stuff on my own. So that's, you know, you don't have to. You can bend the rules, I think, at school if you want to. And I think I studied, I was going to go and do Russian and Japanese. And I changed my mind at the last minute. Time is rolling on. I am curious to know perhaps just one crazy job that we've all had in our life. I've done lots of crazy jobs, but the one that comes to mind, my topic is don't ever go and work in your favourite restaurant. I went to go and work in this Mexican restaurant. And I just, you know, once you've done that, you will never go back there because you see the kitchen, I've been covered in, you know, refried beans. So,
When I left university, I wasn't quite sure what to do with my career. I wasn't sure what kind of job I should take. And somebody found my CV online and sold the dream to me of this amazing sales job with commission. And I thought, you know, I'm quite good at speaking. I like talking to people. And then it was one of those horrible ones where you're ringing up people, convincing them that they've got whiplash. So sorry if you got one of those calls of me. I lasted about 5 weeks though, because it was so horrible.
Well, my craziest job was when I got a position. It was a temporary internship in the anatomy department, and I was working with dead people. It's probably the best job I've had because they couldn't talk back. But actually, there was an incident where a leg of a cadaver actually had been stolen. At least they thought it had been stolen. And it turned out that the group of students had put it in a different tank. But I have to say, it was really gory, and I kind of like went for the goriness of the job. I don't think there was much self-satisfaction, but actually what I learned with doing that job was that, you know, you can even, you know, kind of, I don't know, continue having an impact on people's lives even after your death.
How do you follow that? So I think for me it's the variety, isn't it? And wherever you are, there are people, and I'm always curious about people, and there's always something quirky and something interesting, something to learn from it. For me, so I think it was my second year at university. I came back to Manchester for Christmas and I worked as Santa's helper in Manchester Armdale. And I loved it. It was brilliant because it was just all about people. I got to dress up every day in the middle of the Armdale, and I had, you know, kids screaming as their parents tried to make them smile as they sat on Santa's knee. And you had, you know, the reality of these people that did, you know, were doing that job, that were putting on this show. And I think it was just so refreshing after being at uni and being, you know, I was at Oxford, I was doing law, and this was like, you know, real people in the Armdale, and I absolutely loved it.
Is it important to make a difference with your day job?
I think it is important, but it's at what level is appropriate for you. So I think I mentioned this before, where we can all make a difference in whatever job we're doing, whether it's, you know, a chip shop or it's like even a local paper shop, because we can always make someone smile. No matter what you do, whether you're a social entrepreneur or you're employed, we're all making a difference to society. The point comes where if you want to go and take that to the next level and work on a grander scale for something that you know you're passionate with, then that's important to do as well, because you don't want to get a few years down the line or in your 60s and think, you know what, I wish you'd done that. Then my advice to you as well is just go and do it. But don't worry if you don't feel right for that just yet, because your brain might just need some time to, how can I say, just recalibrate, to understand yourself better. There is no rush, there is no race in life, because we need to take care of ourselves first. I think when we do that, the answers come more readily.
I think, yes, it's important. I think for me, you know, the world has become about fake news, about sometimes those fake heroes and fake icons or people that we worship. And I think we need to bring that back to ourselves. And I think every morning when you get up, I think you have to become your own hero. And I think, you know, we really have to have that, you know, affirmation. And if no one else is going to tell you, tell that to yourself, that you are going to, you know, make a difference that day, no matter how small it is. And I think kind of like every morning you wake up, and not every morning is going to be great, but I think you can make that day great, because, you know, kind of like that hour can become great, and then that month can become great, that year can become great, and it becomes a great life. So I think for me, you know, having that purposeful life is so important, but it has to start from within, and it has to be, you know, self-driven.
The going around has all sorts of bits there, and we could probably talk for another hour or two. So I might ask everyone to give a lovely clap.
I really enjoyed that frank discussion about careers in our sector. And what's refreshing is that it's often not a linear path to how we get here. That was recorded at a recent Flourish event. We have a programme of great events coming up if you're interested in starting or are running a social venture. To find out the latest, simply visit eventbrite.com and search Flourish CIC Manchester. You're listening to the Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast with Flourish CIC. Coming up, we get a first-hand account of what it's like to work at the centre of change-making, from our very own Eve Holt, who is a local councillor here in Manchester. Coming up now is our Flourish Talk section. Our roving producer at large, Vic, was knocking about at the time of our event to find out from our visitors what it's actually like to work in the social goods sector, and also what young people really think of the career advice they're offered in school.
My name's Sis, and I'm the caretaker and founder of Idle Women. Idle Women's an arts and social justice project, and we create spaces for women and girls in places where they're least imagined.
When you were little, did you think that a career changing people's lives would be something that you'd be doing or be viable?
Absolutely not. I was a very angry child. I thought everything was unfair, and that's probably what I'm doing now. But at that time, you know, my horizon was very short. You know, I grew up on a council estate in London, mum, single parent. All I knew in terms of jobs was cleaning, the police, the people that were in my sphere, I thought were job possibilities. I didn't even realise you could go to university until I was much, much older. So,
and do you think it's different now for young people to want to achieve or to have the advice to get a career in the goods causes sector?
Well, you know, woke politics are very in vogue. I think younger people are much more aware of them, unfortunately, much more aware of themselves in that way. They, you know, like with social media, you know, young people rely on validation in a particular way, which I think is, you know, deeply problematic. But they're certainly more aware of what validation can bring. But also, you know, woke politics and social change is, I don't know, it's becoming in vogue. You know, like socially engaged art practice used to be called community art, and now it's a fancy term for social change. And actually, there's been some fantastic community pioneering in social change and art for a very, very long time, and now it's fashionable. But it's great that it's out there, you know, it's all good.
Now, you were saying that you some days you fancy eating crisps in bed. How do you get over those? I just want to go home and go under a duvet days.
I guess I could give you a multifaceted answer to it, I suppose. We work, you know, on the ground on a day-to-day level with women that are forced married, fleeing so-called honour-based violence. We work with women who might never see their kids again, women that probably never see their homes again. So when you're working on the ground like that, you know that your work, even in the smallest of ways, is worth it. We're a CIC, we're not working for the man. Our profit doesn't go to some dude in a yacht. There's that too. And there is a sense of doing something in a time in society that is necessary. It's fucked up. And you know, like, that's why we're doing it. I used to think you could change the institution from working within it, and it's very clear that that's not possible. So by creating your own way of working, you make small changes, and there's a ripple effect. You know, we started out in 2015 with an idea, and then, you know, 4 years later we've got 4 spaces for women that are sustainable. They can't be taken away by austerity cuts, the council, or anyone, and they remain now and trust to women and girls. So, you know, it's worth it.
So I'm Nikisha, I'm from Manchester, but I work for the Wigan Game Changers project, and we're making history. So we go around and we show off our work about the suffragists and the suffragettes.
What would your ideal career be?
I don't know. I would be the mayor one day, Andy Byrne mayor.
And why do you want it? So you want to change lives?
Yeah.
Why is that?
So that women are more free and they can celebrate their differences.
I think you'd be a really good mayor. How can people support you to be mayor? Do you reckon you can do it?
Yeah. As long as I have people on my side, I could be the mayor one day.
Did your school or education at all prepare you for your aspirations to be the mayor?
No. My school, they're not really, really good. So they don't really teach us about that. We learn like 2 + 2 = 4. We don't learn anything about careers and stuff like that. So it doesn't really prepare you. Maybe if we had more visitors to tell, like to talk about careers, and if we had more preparation about what we could do and how we could how we could get there.
It sounds like you're going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Lucy and Brianna, so how old are you both?
15.
16.
What do you want to do as a career? Have you thought about it yet?
No.
A teacher.
Tell me about your careers advice. Where do you get it from?
Well, there's this person at school where you can go to about it, and you can go like online and see it on there.
Do you reckon it's good enough?
Yeah.
Where do you get your careers advice from?
Mostly school.
Is it good?
No. Yeah.
No, it is. It's all right,
it's not.
Actually.
No, it's not. Our school for career advice.
For year 11s, it's good.
For year 9s, it's not. Because they literally don't tell you about anything. They're just like, what do you want to do when you're older? Oh, right, you don't know. That's nice. Move on.
What would you prefer them to do?
Like, explain different jobs so then we can actually understand what we actually want to do.
And what do you want to do?
Be a vet.
And do you think you'll be able to get the support for you to be a vet?
Probably not.
Year 11 career advice, you think it's good?
Yeah, I think it's all right because they obviously know that it's one of the hardest years in your life. So they know that when you leave, you're either going to college, you're going to university, or you're working. So they need to know. I'm going to college and then I want to be a beautician, so I'm planned it out, really.
Hi, my name is Nadia. I'm a youth and community worker in Stockport.
How long have you been a youth and community worker for?
25 years. This is my passion. This is what I believe in, and I believe in making a difference in people's lives where I can. I've always been a freedom fighter from being a little girl, so I've always known what I've wanted in life and how to go about getting it. And because of the changes that I've made in my own personal life and the battles that I've had to fight, that from those experiences, I'm now able to support other people in making a difference to their lifestyle.
Before, has there been any times where you've, in your career as a... Is it as a community youth worker that you felt like, I want to give it up, I want to just get a normal job?
I think only when it comes to government changes, and then the agenda always changes politically, which has a knock-on effect on the grassroots work that we do. Because of all the cuts that have been happening to the public sector, that's had a major effect on what we can offer in the local communities. So, for example, youth centres have closed down due to a lot of the cutbacks on funding, and then, you know, the knock-on effect of not having any local provisions in your local communities, especially in the deprived areas that we work in, where they have such little resources, and we are really struggling to find community buildings to be able to offer creative activities for young people to participate that are on their doorstep, so that they can see that there are opportunities locally for them. They don't have to go too far to start their journey. I think it's really unfortunate that I have to say from the heart that the knock-on effect that it has really saddens me, because I have seen a massive increase in young people's mental health deteriorating, and the effects that that not only does that have on that young person, but the people around them, their peers, their mentors, and how that affects what they do in their daily life, with their home life, with their education, with their social and emotional development. So I think mental health is very much on the increase due to the amount of cutbacks that have been made in public services.
And I can imagine that must make your job just really, really difficult.
It does make it very difficult, because unfortunately we can't give a young person the full support package that they need to be able to enable themselves to become more confident, to build their self-esteem. We just don't have that resources anymore. We don't have enough resources anymore to do that. So what we're seeing is an increase in mental health, young people suffering from mental health. We're seeing an increase in criminal activities. We're seeing an increase in families being pulled apart because they don't know how to manage those emotions and those social situations. Then that has an effect on not just the families, but then the wider community as well. I think the proudest moment in my career would be around helping young people address self-harm and being able to actively signpost them to services to enable them to get help.
Hi, my name is Laura, and I'm a Modern History of the Economics student at the University of Manchester.
Oh, that's a gobful, isn't it?
I know, that's why I had to like prep myself for it a little bit. The background that I'm from, it's quite very much like a working class, poor background. So a lot of people from my school, like the majority did not go to university, so they've gone into those apprenticeship things, and that's probably why there was more support on that. And it was always very much strive for a pass rather than strive for A star excellence, do you know what I mean? And I always took a bit of a problem with that. It was like, at least aim for the best and then you can fall below it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was always just aim for the bare minimum. I grew up in Oldham. So I think for me, it's a lot about the social progression, is that idea that opportunity isn't available to everyone in that sense. And the sense that you may be made to feel small based on the fact that maybe you don't know as much as someone else, or if you've not got as much money. Or maybe more recently, like, gendered, like there's a few things that have happened in my lifetime where I've been like, that's because I'm a girl and because of how I look. And I do take a large issue with it, but it's where to start, isn't it? It's just little steps, I suppose. I think people are generally surprised when I'm at university, and like Uni of Manchester, they'll be quite surprised that I'm from Oldham, and they'll often say, like, what school did you go? And I'll be like, yeah, like, Fales School, and they'll kind of give me a second look, like, why you're here, because there's a lot of, I would say there's quite a lot of middle class people at our university. Would you agree? Yeah. But I don't feel like it's held me back. I think it's all just a mentality thing. I think definitely I can see why you would be, though.
Yeah. And has it made you more, like, determined to...
Yeah.
Like, damn the man.
Damn the man. I do feel like it's something that is supposed to go against me that I won't let go against me.
Yeah, Louise Clark, and I'm a youth support worker at Salford Youth Services. I only found out about youth work because I was one of the young people that used to just turn up to a youth club and just chill out and that. And it was only because I was getting into sort of trouble that I had a youth worker sort of take me under their wing and sort of tell me about things that I could do, and that actually wanting to make a difference in the world was okay, and that actually I could do it as a career. That's how I got into youth work. Well, that's what I try to be. I try to be that youth worker. So follow those skills on. And just, I think, showing young people that who they are is okay, and finding the best of that person and showing that they don't have to change themselves. Sometimes the world needs to change. And so if they don't fit in at school, it's not because there's anything wrong with them. It's something's wrong with the system. Our girls... I've actually talked about doing a campaign about life skills because they feel that school concentrates so much on GCSEs and that they don't know what to do afterwards. Lots of schools talk about college or university, but most young people just want to go and work and have money.
You're listening to the Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast with Flourish CIC. Coming up, we get a first-hand account of what it's like to work at the centre of change making. From my very own Eve Holt, who is a local councillor here in Manchester.
I am Eve, and I'm a councillor at Manchester City Council, and I'm also a director and founder of Happen Together CIC.
Can you remember what started the fire in your belly for social change?
Ooh, so I was born in 1979, a Thatcher child, and grew up in inner city Manchester in the 80s, and I think I had fire in my tummy from a pretty young age in just seeing the level of inequality around me. It was everywhere. It was hard to miss. So I grew up between sort of Chiltern and Whalley Range and on the edge of Moss Side in a very sort of extended fluid family of youth and play workers. So I spent lots of my weekends away on camps with young people who, for whatever reason, were struggling within mainstream school. And I think I just saw, like, day to day that there was just a real sense of people were treated differently and had different opportunities available to them. And there was a very real threat and risk all the time of gun crime, of knife crime. And you would literally see people sort of falling off the tracks, and it felt that there was a lack of safety net or support or real kind of aspiration for everybody equally.
And at that time, seeing all that, did you think that you could make a career out of helping tackle inequality, or... Were you brought up in an environment where that seemed possible?
I think I certainly felt that making change was possible. I was definitely brought up to believe I had power, and that there was power in the collective. I think making a career out of it, possibly not. You know, I was a very activist family, and we spent a lot of time marching, you know, marching for the miners, marching against Clause 28, marching against poll tax. So there was a real sense of activism. I remember, you know, Nelson Mandela, the Berlin Wall. I remember, you know, people that in my life were involved in that. There was a real sense that people were taking action against the things that they saw that were wrong in the world. Whilst they didn't all deliver, there was a sense that progress was made as a consequence. But that was all done very much from a position of activists and volunteers, as opposed to through their jobs. When I look back, obviously, and now I think, well, all those people were actually working generally in the community voluntary sector, or some in the public sector when there was still such a thing as a youth service, and absolutely they were making change day to day, but I don't know that's how I saw it at that point. I don't think that's how I knew it to be. You know, what I saw in the end, what I ended up latching onto was law. So I had one friend whose dad was a very well-known criminal solicitor, and it was very much like he, you know, I saw him in the newspaper standing up for people where they'd been charged, and particularly at a point when there was such a high level of racism. So that's kind of what I latched on as a tool for a career in change making.
Many people might not know that you did. You started out in law as a lawyer.
Yeah, I was one of those unusual types that about age 12 had kind of decided that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a criminal solicitor. And that was my first work experience at secondary school. Went off to a local firm and absolutely loved it. And that's what I then decided to go off and do. You know, there were a few jobs in between. Santa's Little Helper in Manchester Arndale, you know. It was fun. And hey, I was trusted to hold screaming children and try and make them smile. I was definitely on the road to being a politician.
Some people might class you as a mid-career changer. Do you have any advice for anyone who may be thinking that they want to move into a career for social good?
It took a long time. So I did have 15 years as a lawyer, and that was fantastic. So that was initially crime and then asylum and then education, health, social care, public law. And there was probably a long period where I was still a lawyer, but my heart was moving somewhere else. So I'd moved back to Manchester from London and back right in the community that I'd grown up in, and found myself getting more and more involved in local community activism again. And I think it was that process of then going, actually, I found a huge amount of reward with just working with local people and frustration with some of the system as a lawyer. So it took time, I'd say. You know, I know I have seen some people move quickly, but actually it'd be wrong to suggest that I suddenly like woke up one morning and could take that action. And the process involved actually quite a long time of probably voluntary work that was done alongside my career for quite a while. And then gradually I sort of was doing less as a lawyer, and that was creating more space and time for me to do more in the communities, community organiser activism, setting up community projects. But for a while that was very much done as a voluntary thing and seen as a side project before I kind of went, well, actually, this is what I'm getting the most satisfaction out of. How can I make this the thing rather than like a side thing?
You do. It's hard losing an identity. I think anybody that's been in a particular career for a long time, you get used to introducing yourself as a lawyer. And whilst often people had no idea what that actually meant, they just pitched a corporate lawyer and they assumed I was, you know, screwing people over loads of money, and that wasn't the case at all. And when you're doing kind of a very wide mix of community projects, it's hard to explain who you are and what you are, and people often treat people differently depending on their label and their title. And I think when you've invested, you know, a long time, a lot of money in your degree and then post qualifications and then traineeship, letting go of all of that and saying, okay, it's time to move on is not an easy thing to do. So I definitely say seek help, have conversations with people. Now as a coach, I would say seek coaching. I didn't have coaching at the time. It wasn't something that I knew about, but I did have family and friends who were able to talk through quite a lot of that really, and very much support that change process. Yeah, and recognising that you're not going to just be able to necessarily make a kind of side hop. You probably are going to have to explore and experiment, and that means, you know, financially that's really difficult. That's a big thing if you're volunteering or, you know, having a bit of a side hustle. Were you conscious of that and had savings, or were you just very, very meticulous about how you were doing things?
No, I'd say it was hard. We definitely didn't have savings, and actually I had 3 children who were all young, independent, didn't have a pension, not long paid off my student loans. There wasn't a big safety net, but in some ways that actually, it meant it wasn't going to be such a drop off. There was always potential as a lawyer to earn huge amounts of money. That was always there. So I think my partner points went, I thought you were just about to get to that point. At the point that I then go, oh, actually, I'm not going to move into something else. So it was scary. It meant a lot of time, I suppose, of working hard, because I was just juggling lots of different things in order to try and still have some income stream whilst exploring, experimenting. It felt the right thing to do, and certainly now it feels like the right thing to do. So it was worth it.
Was there any element of retraining, or were you quite surprised at the amount of transferable skills that you had? For example, Santa's Little Helper and the kiddies.
Stood me in very good stead. Yeah. Yeah, no, most of it has been transferable. I think it's more in practice I was ready to get on and do the things I wanted to do. It was whether I believed that I could, and that whole imposter syndrome was definitely there and big and present, ever present. And I think having had you know, a career that had involved huge amount of training in order to call myself a lawyer. You know, there was a lot that went on. It didn't feel easy to just suddenly adopt another name. I thought, well, I've got to surely spend years now, you know, to become a coach. So I had quite a while I was coaching and people were saying, you are a coach. And I went on training of other coaches who'd been doing years and they were like, you're a great coach. But I was like, oh, I can't call myself that because I don't feel I've got the qualification, the stamp of approval. So I felt like a fraudster in my other hats for quite a long time. And there was a long time where I still had like, on my Twitter or LinkedIn, it still said lawyer, you know, it says lister, because I couldn't quite call myself something else and feel like that was legitimate. But in practice, I was doing it. All the stuff that I'd been doing for all those years had all been effectively coaching people just as a lawyer, you know. Yeah. That's what I was doing. I was facilitating meetings all the time, more professional meetings. I was delivering training all the time. I was out being an advocate for people. So it was all there. It was just under a different label. And it took a while to unpick that and realise that actually, you know, I could do these other things.
Yeah, it's not just retraining your skills and the hard stuff, but also mentally and...
Absolutely. And it still says on there, I think, it still says, you know, counsellor, coach, facilitator, change maker, lawyer or something. Yes. And I guess a bit of it goes, well, I probably always will. Yeah, don't ask me for legal advice.
I don't know about you, but there's more of a general wokeness around.
Yeah.
Have you noticed there's more people wanting to get into changing the world?
Yeah, definitely. But all the research and evidence shows the same as well. You know, we've got huge increase in people setting up as social entrepreneurs and particularly women. But I know lots of people now that have set out on that journey over the last 5 years. And I think it is far more present and it's far more well known, actually. When we set up our community interest company, people were just like, what? What's a social entrepreneur? And they still looked at you blankly. I think that shifted. And I think in terms of just more change making more broadly, I think we've seen a real increase again over the last few years of protest, people again feeling like actually they need some agency and having agency and going, actually we need power. And you know, people power feels like again it's become just far more present across all parts of our communities. And I think that's a really positive thing. I think it does often happen in response to something else, doesn't it? So I don't think it's a coincidence that I guess growing up in the 80s I saw people power. I saw lots of people also in jobs that were really making changes in the community. And that was when it was so present that actually inequality was so much in people's minds, both at home and across the world. And I think the same's happened as well over recent years. You know, inequality has grown and people in Manchester certainly feel it. And I think people then react to that.
Yeah, and I think that really helps if people are thinking about starting a career or sustaining a career in social change, is that you're not on your own.
Absolutely, and there's so much support out there. I think there needs to be more support. You know, obviously we sat here in Federation House, and that's great. And this provides some support in terms of space for people. It's great to be surrounded by other people that are also looking at how to make social change, and you know, people support each other and share ideas. I think we've got a long way to go, both in terms of providing physical spaces, because that is a huge obstacle, you know, both in terms of having somewhere to work and just bring people together. We're limited in space, and space often comes at a price, and that really squashes a lot of the room for creativity and for collective action.
So you mentioned earlier about having to change sort of like labels from previous careers to new careers. Do you encounter any misconceptions from people when you say that you're a change maker?
I think I use a different word every time. I don't think I ever just use change maker. If I do, it probably comes with something else. I think there's often a curiosity as to what that means. I don't feel like I've ever had people easily immediately get what it is that I do, I guess. For the same reasons for a lawyer, there was a massive misconception with that, hugely, as to what people assumed you did to what I actually did. It does need explaining. It can sound very arrogant, can't it, really? That's probably why I don't use it very often. I think I kind of hesitated. I probably deleted it several times on my LinkedIn and then replaced it going, I don't know what else to put. But it can sound like, I am the change. And, you know, I don't think that's the case. I do like be the change. You know, there is the be the change you want to see in the world. well, I don't think on your own you can be, you can change everything. But I do think any change has to start with you and being really self-aware and open about that. We all need other people to help us.
So that's a really good starting point, I think, for anyone wanting to, or thinking about starting a career in social good, is to start with yourself.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. If you don't know what you're trying to achieve and you don't know what you bring and you don't know where your own kind of blind spots are, it's going to be very difficult.
Mm.
And, you know, self-care is so key, isn't it? I think we've seen so many people just burn out through then trying to make change. And, you know, a huge number of women in particular are really driven by a wish to help make change and do social good, and often without funding and resources. And then you burn out and then you're no good to anybody and you're not modelling the stuff that you're talking about. So
there's a lot of pressure then. And this is all down to the labels that you call yourself and the pressure you put on yourself and pressures through funding. So yeah, look after yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Look after yourself. Absolutely. And I think it's looking after yourself and it's looking after those around you, isn't it? And always recognising, meeting things with passion. I think, and you have to find your allies and you have to step out of your current bubbles and make sure you're getting a diversity of perspectives and people and spaces and ideas and tools.
And that's the exciting thing.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah.
So you were elected as a councillor for Manchester City Council last year.
Yeah.
Can you still be a change maker in the constraints of a local authority?
Ooh, killer question. I obviously think yes. I mean, I've been involved in politics, basically the whole of my life within the Labour Party, and, you know, for majority that obviously that as an activist, I would not have stepped in to formal politics in a role unless I felt that was to affect change. And I was very clear about that. It had to be at a point that I felt I could make a difference, otherwise I'll be somewhere else doing something else. Life's too short, really. So that's why that felt like the right time for me, for various reasons. It felt like the right place. And in terms of what's going on in the world, what's going on in Manchester, it felt like a point at which actually there was a need for change and there was an opportunity to help with others kind of put shoulder to the wheel in driving that change. So yeah, I happily, you'll see change maker still sits next to councillor. How you do that obviously is different. And I think there isn't a clearly defined job description for you as a councillor, you know, so how you approach things, how you best represent your residents, how you best scrutinise decisions of the executive, how you be, you know, an ambassador for your party, for the city, for individuals within it. Lots of people do that in different ways. And obviously for some, that is very much around maybe some of the structures and the rules. And it's maybe believing that they provide a tool for delivering that, and you know, for others you feel like you're trying to shift a lot of those things. And I think I naturally am more of a place of feeling that there's needs for shifts, really. I think, you know, politics, like law, is a very old institution which for that reason has been, you know, built largely by white men to serve their purposes. And that doesn't mean that is now that, you know, that we shouldn't have white men in there, absolutely, but it's so embedded in all the fabric and all the decisions and the way things are made, and that has to change if it's going to best represent and work for the huge diversity of people that are now, you know, involved in our communities and in civic life. So there is a change that's needed.
Is it challenging?
Yeah. Did you want more of an answer than that?
No, that's right.
Yeah, no, it brings an equal amount of absolute joy and frustration. It brings huge joy because you get to interact with a huge number of people, and we really do have more in common than that divides us. We really do. Joe Cox's statement is alive and kicking in all those spaces, and you see that people, the vast, vast majority, 99.99% of people, do you know what? They just want to live a good life and they want to look after the people around them and they care about the world. And they might have a whole load of pressures that make some choices really difficult for them. And that's the same for councillors. Councillors came in generally as frustrated or angry residents who thought actually something needs to be done better and maybe I can help. But once you're in, there is, you know, there are necessarily huge numbers of boundaries, and that's needed. You know, governance is important, transparency of rules is important, people having clear roles and responsibilities, but that makes it a, you know, it's a tanker that takes a long time to move. And as I said, you know, the culture and the way things are done are so old and so ingrained that it can be incredibly frustrating when you can have a group of people who can see there's a, maybe there's something they want to achieve, and then you look at the timetable, oh my god, you're like, we're all sat there going, yes, this is what needs to happen, and it can be something quite small, you know, quite a small policy change, and you're like, oh, that's going to take 3 years, and it's about real people's lives, and you're going, but these people in our communities need this now. That is painful. That is really, really challenging. And trusting that that is right, that's because these things have a due process. And honestly, I mean, it would take a lifetime to get to know every rule and regulation. And then, you know, to do that alongside building relationships and trust and having energy and self-care and frankly having another job in order to financially sustain yourself and a family and a life is not possible. So you have to pick and choose and rely on others to be able to tell you where, which battles to pick and what opportunities to seize.
There might be a barrier to some people being a counsellor thinking that they don't know, and they don't know it all. But you're saying you don't have to know it all.
You really don't. No one knows it all. And it needs people coming with all their different approaches to it. So someone that steps in and they bring their own personal life experience is usually valid, because they'll cut through a lot of other stuff just because they'll have had their experience and they'll be able to bring that perspective to the table. If you want to be representative, and you know, particularly as a Labour Party, where you know our key values around equality and diversity, and we want to be there for the many, then you do have to look like the many, and that means you have to create a space that anybody feels welcome to step in, everyone can make a contribution in, and then we stand a chance of actually being able to, you know, well represent.
What's your, just final question, what's your proudest moment to date?
I don't like that question.
Okay, do you want to give me like a top two?
So if you're gonna, are you going to make me pick some? Yeah, when I look back, actually, so this is interesting. Now, recently we had to empty out our cellar because we're getting insulated on our mission to cut our carbon footprint. And I found a box of all my old stuff from school and bits from uni that I'd held on to. And it included some sheets from when I was at university. So I went to Oxford for law. You know, my family all had kind of advised against, really, and in fact they felt it was breaking all our values. Had been very clearly sent to the local maintained school, even when other people were pulled out for all sorts of reasons, but you know, teachers really pushed me and said that that was a way that I could affect change. And it felt like a good way, actually, to step out of my bubble into another bubble. Certainly was a bubble, but, you know, it opens your eyes to things. And actually, in my second year, what I found in my cellar was notes from, I'd taken myself off to the University of Westminster once a week. So as a member of Amnesty International, and somehow it ended up signing up to do this programme on capital punishment, which was at the University of Westminster. So when I look back, I think, gosh, I was only, 19? And I chose to still find my own way to Amnesty International, and then found my own way to leave Oxford once a week, go to a different university, sit in a room with different people, did that programme, and as a consequence went off to South Carolina for a summer and had an amazing 2 months working with a fantastic lawyer, defending people who were facing murder charges and the death penalty, and campaigning against death penalty. And I guess it was finding that made me realise that even at that point, you know, wrapped up in a bubble, I managed to find a way out, and that served me really well because it was the best summer and job ever, and it really cemented for me what I wanted to do, at a point that I was being bombarded by all the magic law firms, and that's what most of my colleagues were looking at. So, you know, I remember my law professor even saying, human rights, what's that? be curious about, yeah, the world around you.
I like that, and that really just, that's a nice bit of advice to close on, is that Get out of your bubble.
Yeah.
Pop your bubble.
Yeah. Get out of your bubble.
Thank you very much, Eve. That was lovely.
Lovely to talk to you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of our Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast. And we hope we've given you some inspiration on starting or propelling your career in this wonderful social good sector.
To tell the world about Flourish in this podcast, or perhaps suggest a subject you'd like to discuss, connect with us on Twitter at FlourishCIC.
A big thanks to our panellists, Eve, and of course, to you for listening. There are lots of ways for you to get involved with what we do here at Flourish. So connect with us via our website, flourishtogether.org.uk. And to tell the world about Flourish and this podcast, or perhaps suggest a topic you'd like us to discuss here, tweet us at FlourishCIC.
The next episode is all about PR and marketing in your social enterprise, including a chat with media darlings Yellow Jigsaw. We can't wait to see you then.
Supporting Women in Social Enterprise is a Mike Media production and is produced and edited by Vic Elizabeth Turnbull.